Okay, so today we're diving into this really interesting period, the American Revolution, but we're going to be looking at it through a kind of a different lens, the lens of religion. And you shared some really fascinating material with me, excerpts from this lecture series on American Christianity. And so we're going to kind of use this material to, well, just unpack some key insights and see if we can't find some of those surprising connections that often get missed, and ultimately help us all understand how the theological and the social forces at play at the time really shaped, this pivotal moment in American history.
Yeah, I think this material really provides us with a rich opportunity to sort of explore the intertwined nature of religious thought and burgeoning desire for independence in the colonies. And we're going to be tracing how religious beliefs and practices kind of evolved in the lead up to the revolution, and examine their impact on the drive for self-governance.
Okay, well, let's dive right in then with the First Great Awakening. Now, this wasn't just, your typical or standard religious movement. It really had this widespread impact on American life and culture during the 18th century, and that's where the lecture series starts. And so we'll kind of pick up there and explore some of its key results, from this idea of the elevation of the common person to the emergence of new forms of assembly. Entirely new ways for people to come together.
Yeah, the First Great Awakening was really a transformative period. It was it's fascinating how a movement that centered on religious revival could generate such a profound social and even political shifts. So it really underscores just how interconnected colonial life was.
Yeah, it really is interesting to think about how those things were all tied together. Okay, well, so from there, we're going to shift gears a little bit and look at deism, this 18th century intellectual movement that's really crucial for understanding the religious and political theories of the founding fathers. And so we'll break down some of the core tenets of deism and explore its influence on, some key thinkers of the era, and also consider how, more traditional religious groups responded to its growing popularity.
Yeah, deism offers this really important perspective. I think a move towards reason and natural law that stands in contrast to more orthodox religious views. And I think understanding its principles is essential for grasping the philosophical foundations upon which the revolution was built. And this emphasis on natural law, by the way, was a core tenet of the Enlightenment, suggesting that universal moral principles could be discovered through reason and observation of the natural world, independent of religious texts. So it's important to sort of see how those ideas start to weave together.
Okay, so then finally, we're going to be taking on this really complex topic, the political and religious theories of the founding fathers themselves. And there's this pretty common assumption out there, I think, that they were all devout evangelical Christians. But the lecture material that you shared actually offers a more nuanced picture, highlighting the influence of deism and thinkers like Rousseau, and really kind of questioning that simple narrative. So we've got a lot to unpack, I
Yeah,
found.
we do. It's a multifaceted story, and it requires us to kind of move beyond those simple labels and really delve into the complexities of the historical context, which I think brings up an interesting point right from the start. How do we reconcile, the intense religious fervor of the Great Awakening with what seems to be a different intellectual framework guiding the founding fathers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the lecture gives us a starting point, I think, by looking at some of the direct outcomes of the First Great Awakening. It talks about this elevation of the common person. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. It sounds like this revival really empowered ordinary church members, the laity, in ways that they hadn't experienced before.
Yeah, what's fascinating here is the shift in agency. Suddenly individuals felt more empowered to actively participate in their church life. This included things like, speaking publicly, reading the Bible aloud, activities that were often, largely reserved for the clergy up to that point. And so this shift in agency within the church was revolutionary in a way, because it instilled in ordinary individuals a sense of their own importance and capacity to to influence the world around them.
Yeah.
And this newfound confidence and participatory mindset arguably formed a crucial psychological foundation for challenging political authority later on. So it wasn't just about church. It was about people realizing their voices mattered.
Right. So it wasn't just the priests or the ministers calling all the shots anymore.
Exactly.
Leadership in the church became more shared with the laity. And that feels like a pretty, you know, significant social shift, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, you know, this newfound empowerment in the religious sphere likely had broader consequences.
Right.
It fostered this sense of individual agency and the idea that ordinary people could have a voice and participate in, you know, important aspects of their community.
Yeah. And that seems to tie directly into this next point, the personal independence in religious life, which then kind of bled over into a desire for personal independence in political life.
Right.
And ultimately the separation of church and state.
Precisely. The freedom of choice in religion that was emphasized during the Awakening, you know, nurtured the sense of personal autonomy. And we need to remember the historical context here. Many colonists, like the Baptists, the Roman Catholics, some Puritans, had fled state-sponsored religious oppression in Europe.
Right.
Their desire for a clear separation between church and state was deeply ingrained. Mm-hmm. They didn't want the government telling them how to worship.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this newfound emphasis on individual religious choice then translate into a desire for political autonomy?
Right.
Was it a direct connection, or were there other factors at play?
That's something I was wondering myself as I was listening to this.
Well, the experience of questioning religious authority and asserting individual conscience in matters of faith likely normalized the idea of questioning other forms of authority, including political authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if individuals felt empowered to choose their own relationship with God.
Right.
The idea of choosing their own form of government wouldn't have seemed so far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
And the desire to avoid a repeat of European religious conflicts where state power was used to enforce religious conformity also played a significant role in advocating for the separation of church and state.
That makes perfect sense if you've experienced that kind of oppression firsthand. You're going to be pretty wary of any system that even hints at it.
Exactly.
Okay, well, the lecture also brings up this new humanitarian impulse stemming from the First Great Awakening, and it links it to that passage in Matthew 22, love God, love your neighbor.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is the interpretation of neighbor that emerged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Wesley, for example, emphasized that your neighbor wasn't just someone like you or in your immediate circle, but rather the poorest among you. And the one who was most helpless among you.
Right.
So this really broadened the scope of Christian responsibility.
Yeah. And the lecture gives this powerful example of this with George Whitefield building an orphanage in Georgia.
Yeah.
That's a pretty concrete manifestation of this new humanitarian focus.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just about spiritual salvation. It was also about addressing the physical needs of the community.
Exactly. Whitefield's actions demonstrate how the theological emphasis on loving one's neighbor translated into tangible social action.
Yeah.
And this impulse would continue to shape American life and culture in the centuries that followed.
Now let's talk about these new forms of assembly. The lecture highlights two key characteristics with both religious and political implications.
Okay.
And first, the social context.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just happening in church buildings anymore, right?
That's a crucial point. Ugh. Assemblies moved beyond the confines of established churches to open air settings, and this made them accessible to a much wider range of people, regardless of their church membership or social standing.
Mm-hmm.
It created a more inclusive social space,
and
this shift in who could participate then led to these new ways they started to gather.
So suddenly you have people from all walks of life coming together in these public spaces.
Yeah.
And the second characteristic is the ability within these contexts to criticize authority, both religious and later political.
What's fascinating here is the emergence of this public discourse and the challenging of established authority,
mm-hmm.
you know, the open air nature of these assemblies provided a platform for individuals to voice dissent and critique leadership in ways that might not have been possible within the more hierarchical structures of traditional churches. This undoubtedly had a training effect for political discourse later on.
Yeah, it's almost like these religious gatherings were a testing ground for new forms of social interaction and even political expression.
Right.
And this leads to the idea of the sovereignty of the people becoming critical to political office.
This is a really, really important shift. Mm-hmm. The lecture points out that leadership previously was often based on connections, wealth, influence, and power.
Mm-hmm.
But the first Great Awakening, with its emphasis on individual conscience and popular participation in religious life, paved the way for this idea that political authority ultimately derives from the people themselves and the voice of the common person started to carry more weight.
Yeah. And then we get to this really strong statement in the lecture that the first Great Awakening can be seen as the first stage of the American Revolution.
Right.
That's a pretty bold claim.
It is. But when you... when you consider the social upheaval, the empowerment of the individual, the new forms of assembly that fostered critical thinking and challenged authority, you can see the argument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a significant social event that fundamentally shifted power dynamics and ways of thinking in the colonies.
It's like it laid the groundwork psychologically and socially for people to even conceive of breaking away from established authority on a political level.
Absolutely.
Now, the lecture also touches on the term evangelical.
Yeah.
And how it was understood during the First Great Awakening. It's not quite the same as how we use it today, is it?
That's right. During the Reformation, evangelical was largely used to distinguish Protestantism from Roman Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
It was associated with the emphasis on the gospel.
Right.
And figures like Jonathan Edwards would have identified with that meaning.
Mm-hmm.
However, its usage evolved significantly by the mid-20th century.
Right.
So the key takeaway here is that while the individuals involved in the First Great Awakening might have used the term evangelical, it carried a different set of connotations than it does in contemporary discourse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was more tied to the Reformation context and in England to the Wesleyan revival, which was happening concurrently.
Okay, so the First Great Awakening was this powerful force shaping American society in really fundamental ways.
Yeah.
But then we move into the 18th century more broadly, the Age of Reason, and we encounter deism.
Right.
What exactly was this movement all about?
The 18th century, as lecture notes, was indeed known as the Age of Reason or rationality.
Mm-hmm.
There was a real emphasis on the power of human reason and a growing skepticism towards aspects of traditional Christianity that were perceived as irrational or not empirically verifiable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that gave rise to natural theology, this idea of understanding God through reason and observing the natural world.
Exactly. Natural theology argued that the beauty, the order, and the design evident in the universe pointed to the existence of a creator.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way of knowing God through observation rather than solely through scripture or religious tradition.
But the lecture points out two key flaws with this approach.
Okay.
One being its neglect of revealed theology, you know, scripture and the person of Christ.
That's a critical limitation in natural theology. By focusing solely on reason and observation, often sideline the importance of divine revelation as presented in the Bible. And through Jesus, it struggled to account for the specific claims and narratives of Christian scripture.
Right. And the other flaw was its difficulty in explaining suffering and natural disasters.
Yeah.
If the world was designed so perfectly and orderly by a benevolent creator.
Precisely. The existence of earthquakes, floods, diseases, you know, the darker aspects of the natural world posed a significant challenge to a purely optimistic view of a creator derived solely from beauty and order.
Mm-hmm.
It raised questions about the nature and attributes of this distant, reasoned God.
Now, the lecture also mentions these, prolonged religious wars in Europe as a contributing factor to the rise of deism.
Mm.
And, you know, people were kind of fed up with the conflict associated with traditional religious doctrines.
Absolutely. The centuries of religious conflict in Europe created a desire for a more rational and less divisive approach to faith. And deism, with its emphasis on universal principles discoverable by reason, offered an alternative to the seemingly endless theological disputes that had fueled so much bloodshed.
Right. And then John Locke comes along with his book, The Reasonableness of Christianity.
Right.
And he argued that the basic truths of Christianity were actually rational.
Yeah, Locke's work was influential in bridging the gap between reason and faith. He argued that the fundamental tenets of Christianity could be understood and accepted through rational inquiry, drawing partly on natural theology, the order and design of the world.
But even though Locke still used the Bible, his followers started to rely more and more on reason alone, eventually kind of setting scripture aside.
That's the key transition. While Locke still engaged with scripture, the logical progression for some of his followers was to conclude that if reason alone could lead to an understanding of God and morality, then the Bible became less necessary, or at least its authority was diminished.
Right. And this brings us to the definition of deism itself, a religious philosophy that posits a distant God who created the world, but isn't actively involved in its affairs, like a clockmaker who winds up the clock and then leaves it to run.
That's a classic analogy for deism. It contrasts sharply with theism, which emphasizes a personal and interventionist God who engages with humanity and the world. Deism essentially envisions a creator who set the universe in motion according to natural laws and then stepped back.
Okay, so what were some of the core beliefs of the deists?
The lecture outlines several key beliefs. Firstly, they were monotheists, believing in one God, but they generally rejected the Trinity, leading to Unitarianism. Secondly, they acknowledged sin but attributed it to free will rather than original sin. Thirdly, they place a strong emphasis on morality and ethics, believing a virtuous life was possible without the concept of original sin. And finally, they generally believed in an afterlife with rewards and punishments, though the specifics of heaven and hell were less defined, eventually evolving into universalism, the idea that everyone would ultimately be saved.
Okay, we had some key writers who really championed deism, like John Toland with Christianity Not Mysterious, arguing that nothing in the Bible is above reason.
Toland's work was quite radical for its time. He essentially argued that if any part of the Bible contradicted reason, then that part should be discarded. He sought to strip Christianity of what he considered to be irrational elements or mysteries.
Okay. And then Matthew Tindall with Christianity as Old as Creation.
Right.
Advocating for understanding scripture through reason rather than divine revelation.
Tindall went even further, suggesting that true Christianity was essentially synonymous with natural law and reason discoverable through observing the created order. He viewed scripture not as a unique divine revelation, but as a confirmation of these universal rational principles. So for him, Christianity was about order, beauty, and design, just like the cosmos.
Now, unsurprisingly, this rise of deism didn't go unchallenged.
Right.
How did more Orthodox Christians respond?
The lecture describes three main ways Orthodox Christianity responded. Firstly, they tried to find common ground with deists by acknowledging the order, the beauty, and the design in the world as evidence of God's handiwork. Secondly, they defended the entire biblical record, including miracles, prophecies, and the incarnation, arguing that faith involved more than just rational understanding. And thirdly, they advocated for faith-seeking understanding. emphasizing the importance of reason while also recognizing its limitations and the existence of mystery in God's ways, with figures like Jonathan Edwards playing a key role in this intellectual defense.
Mm-hmm.
Edwards, for instance, while deeply committed to Reformed theology,
mm-hmm.
also engaged with Enlightenment thought,
mm-hmm.
seeking to demonstrate the reasonableness of Christian belief while still upholding the authority of Scripture.
Okay, so we have this backdrop of the First Great Awakening,
yeah.
and the rise of deism. Mm-hmm. Now we get to the really controversial part.
Mm-hmm.
The political and religious theories of the Founding Fathers in the lecture puts forward the thesis that most of the key Founding Fathers were not evangelical Christians,
mm-hmm.
but were significantly influenced by deism.
Yeah, this is a crucial and often debated point.
Mm-hmm.
The lecture challenges the traditional narrative
mm-hmm.
by suggesting that the intellectual leaders of the revolution were primarily operating within a deistic framework,
mm-hmm.
which significantly shaped their views on both religion and politics.
And Thomas Jefferson is presented as a prime example of this, even writing his own version of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where he cut out the miracles.
Yeah, Jefferson's actions with the Jefferson Bible are quite telling.
Mm-hmm.
By removing the miracles, mm-hmm. he was essentially trying to create a version of Jesus that aligned with 18th century rational thought, portraying
right.
him more as a moral philosopher
yeah.
than a divine figure
wow.
whose life included supernatural events.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications of removing core tenets like the death and resurrection
mm-hmm.
are significant.
Now the lecture also highlights the influence of Rousseau's social contract
mm-hmm.
on Jefferson and other founding fathers,
yeah.
noting its deistic underpinnings.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the key ideas from this work
yeah.
that resonated with them?
Rousseau's Social Contract was a hugely influential text
mm.
that challenged the traditional divine right of kings,
mm.
asserting instead that political authority
mm.
originates from the people.
Mm-hmm.
It introduced the concept of the general will of the people
mm.
as the basis for just laws
mm-hmm.
and framed the social contract
mm-hmm.
as a balance between safeguarding individual freedom
mm.
and establishing a government that serves the common good.
Right.
These ideas were incredibly powerful in the context of the American Revolution and,
mm.
and colonists' struggle against what they perceived as British tyranny.
And when we look at the Declaration of Independence,
mm.
the language used seems to reflect this
mm.
this deistic influence,
mm.
you know, the appeal
yeah. is to self-evident truths
right.
and an endowment by their creator, not a direct appeal
mm-hmm.
to biblical revelation or a redeemer God.
That's a very insightful observation,
mm-hmm.
The Declaration's appeal to self-evident truths,
mm-hmm.
you know, roots its arguments in philosophical reasoning.
Right.
Rather than specific religious doctrines,
mm.
the reference to their creator is a more general deistic term
mm-hmm.
rather than a specific invocation of the Christian God
yeah.
and the emphasis on inalienable rights
mm-hmm.
like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness,
mm-hmm.
along with the concept of government deriving its power from the consent of the governed,
mm-hmm.
aligns strongly with Enlightenment ideals
mm-hmm.
and the principles outlined in the social contract.
And the lecture points out
mm-hmm.
how the American constitutional framework broke with this idea of state-controlled religion,
mm-hmm.
you know, rejecting religious tests.
Right. For office holders.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Christianity paradoxically flourished under this separation.
This is a fascinating outcome
yeah.
by preventing the government from establishing or favoring any particular religion,
mm-hmm.
the Constitution created a space for religious pluralism to thrive.
Right.
The absence of state control
mm-hmm.
allowed different denominations, including Christianity and even the first Jewish synagogue in Rhode Island
mm.
to flourish independently
mm.
based on their own merits
mm-hmm.
and the voluntary support of their Got adherents. It.
Okay, so can we really call America a Christian nation based on the intentions of the Founding Fathers?
Mm-hmm.
The lecture seems to suggest
mm-hmm.
only in a limited sense, meaning a nation
yeah.
with a large Christian population
mm-hmm.
and some Judeo-Christian cultural influence.
Mm-hmm.
But but not one founded as a explicitly evangelical Christian state based on the entire Bible.
That's the nuanced argument being made while many Americans at the time were Christian.